And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay interview.
Hello, everyone. There was a time when the British non-diplomatic community in Geneva hardly knew or saw the UK's permanent representative to the United Nations and other international organizations for two reasons. We, and here I speak as a member of that British community, we had a consul general who headed up the British consulate in Geneva and who functioned, among other things, in a sort of pastoral role towards the British community. All that very sadly is gone now in Geneva. The British embassy in Bern now has, as it always had, oversight and overall responsibility for bilateral matters. The permanent representative to the UN Geneva became a lot more visible in the Geneva region, at least as far as some multilateral trade matters are concerned, when David Cameron became Prime Minister and William Hague's Foreign Secretary. The Foreign and Commonwealth Office suddenly became much more commercial and open to matters, at least business matters, around that time. I think it was around 2010, if my memory serves me correctly, that some of us came to see rather more of the UK's permanent representative. Now, it's not too good to get too attached to itinerant diplomats because they're usually moving on after 3 or 4 years. Well, today's a sad occasion, and I speak personally because a very likable and very talented ambassador and PR, permanent representative, who's been placed here by the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office in London for the unusual length of 6 years, is leaving shortly. In fact, I think his furniture is being piled into a removal truck as we speak. My guest today is Ambassador Julian Braithwaite. We're talking via Zoom, which still largely governs our lives, at least as far as coming together is concerned and meeting one another face to face as we used to. Welcome or welcome back to the McKay interview, Ambassador. Welcome, Julian.
Thanks, Michael. Delighted to be on your show this morning.
It's good to see you. Look, and I must tell the listeners that he's dressed very elegantly for me, and I don't deserve it, in a dark blue suit and dark tie. Classic ambassadorial attire. Well done, Ambassador. Julian, it's a sad occasion, as I said, because I know that I speak for all of the listeners who've come to know you during the 6 years that you've been here in Geneva when I say that we like you and we will miss you and we wish you well wherever your next career move representing the best interests of the United Kingdom happens to be. And it's because you're so good at what you do and a consummate communicator that I need your help, Julian, in finding the answers to some of the complex questions I have for you about the exciting events of your time here before you ride off into the sunset. Julian, here we are at the end of March 2021, almost 3 months after the UK's complete separation from the European Union. I know that the World Trade Organization dossier has been a big one on your desk. Please tell me where the UK is now situated as far as international trading rules are concerned. And as a specific rider to that, should matters arising from the trade across the Irish Sea and across the borderless border of the island of Ireland be regarded as merely teething troubles, and Cabinet Minister Michael Gove recently admitted that they were a bit more than that, or a trading and political crisis in the making?
So, Michael, lots of questions there, but to answer your first and overarching question, I mean, the UK is now an independent member of the World Trade Organization in its own right, as of the 1st of January of this year, actually. And that's the first time that has been the case. Well, we've never been an independent member of the World Trade Organization because we're part of the European Economic Community when the WTO was founded in 1995. And we haven't really been an independent member of its predecessor, the GATT, obviously, since the early 1970s. So it was quite a big moment. And we left the European Union politically a year ago. But we weren't yet independent in the WTO. We're still covered by the transition period of the withdrawal agreement, and the UK respected its obligations under that treaty during that year. And so we were following, for the most part, European positions, the EU positions. But this year, from the 1st of January, we're able to really decide what we think for ourselves and to use the UK's not inconsiderable weight, actually, within the WTO to help shape the future of that organisation and the future of the global trading system. And I have some very ambitious ministers back in London who are determined to do just that. On your second question, which is the agreements between the United Kingdom and the European Union, and particularly the Northern Ireland Protocol, which forms part of the withdrawal agreement. I mean, no one can say that this is simple or easy. Yeah. But it is very important. I mean, the reason we agreed to the Northern Ireland Protocol is because both sides, put peace in Northern Ireland first. And the objective of avoiding the reintroduction of the sort of the borders of the past that Michael, you'll remember from, you know, from the 1990s and before.
I was living in England at the time.
And that is, you know, that is why we have this agreement. It is difficult. It does involve some novel and complex arrangements. We hope that, you know, the difficulties that we're dealing with at the moment are of the sort that once we've put in place the sort of proper administrative procedures and that they're well understood by the businesses using them, they will largely disappear. But, you know, that's, you know, nothing is guaranteed. It requires goodwill on both sides to implement this agreement in the spirit in which it was arrived at, in order to reduce tensions in Ireland and in Northern Ireland, not to increase them. And that's, but, you know, that requires both sides to look at it in those, in that, with that ultimate goal in mind. This isn't about, you know, nickel and diming trade rules. This is about peace in Northern Ireland, and both sides need to look at it in that way. And I hope that is how it will develop over the coming weeks and months.
Well, as a corollary to that question, and you can understand why many of us in the British community were puzzled at the sort of kerfuffle that was going on. Is the United Kingdom a reliable and honourable partner when it comes to keeping its word on treaties and agreements that it signed up to? Because we had this bluster some time ago, or at least it seemed to be bluster, that Britain might consider breaking international law. And for us far away from London, from the UK, it just sounded very odd, very out of character.
Well, the UK hasn't broken international law. And, you know, this has been a very difficult international negotiation. I mean, it's probably the most difficult trade negotiation the UK will ever be involved in. You know, this wasn't a sort of a coming together. It was a bit like a divorce, I'm afraid, with all of the, I'm afraid, the acrimony that involves. And so some of the, you know, some of the rhetoric and the way in which it was played on both sides was, you know, not, you know, was quite tough at times. But the UK has, I mean, I can speak for how the UK has behaved here in the WTO. And what we've gone through in the WTO, as we've left the EU, is novel and unprecedented. But the UK has sought always to reassure its partners that we do respect the rules here. We're trying to use them as best as they can be applied to our unique circumstances, and to develop a reputation for the UK as we become an independent member of the WTO, that we are a friend of the system, a friend of the rules, that we'll work with other countries that genuinely believe in using the global trading system to remove the barriers to trade. And I think that's actually the, you know, that is the reputation that we have managed to develop so far. The proof of the pudding will be in the eating. It's what we do next that will matter. But that's the point about Brexit ultimately, is that, you know, whether it's a success or whether it's not, now depends on the UK, and that's the point. And we now need to demonstrate, having gone through this very difficult period, that the UK is still the UK outside of the EU. We still stand for the rule of law. We still stand for trade liberalisation. We stand, we hope, usually, it's not always the case, all countries have complex interests, but we stand on the right side of the argument, and we stand on the progressive side of the argument. And that, I think, is what the UK is demonstrating and will demonstrate in the future. As I say, every country, particularly a country like the UK, has very complex combination of different interests, and foreign policy is a balance of those interests. And you know, we're not a non-governmental organisation. We're not activists and campaigners. We represent the whole of the UK's interests. But throughout my career in the Foreign Office, I've felt that more often than not, the UK has been on the right side of the argument, and that's why I've been proud to serve the British government.
Well, Julian, the next question is no less complicated, and it's good to have you as an experienced practitioner in diplomacy to help me understand this one. The late Robin Cook, and I'm sure you must have known him, as you once Tony Blair's Foreign and Commonwealth Secretary, tried to implement, when he was Foreign Minister, an ethical foreign policy. Now, in the light of your role representing the best interests of Her Majesty's government at the UN Geneva, can you explain for me, for my benefit and the listeners across Switzerland and beyond, the complexities and the nuances of ethics and foreign policy in the UK's multilateral agenda that you've managed here in Geneva, including human rights? Now, I have in mind in particular Julian, we've discussed this before. Just one example, the recent announcement by President Biden's new administration temporarily to freeze sales of weapons to both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. How does the UK square that awkward circle when it makes so much money in its sale of weapons to Saudi and the Gulf? And they constitute, as you know, a lucrative part of the UK's economy and a market share bigger than Russia and France.
So as I was mentioning earlier, I mean, the UK's foreign policy is the amalgam of many different interests. And we're not, you know, we're not Human Rights Watch. We're not Amnesty International. We're the British government. We represent the British taxpayer and the British electorate. The UK's security and its prosperity are at the center of our foreign policy. But, you know, we also believe that that actually the prosperity and security of others and a system of international relations based on predictable rules that are respected, on the rule of law, if you like, is actually also in the UK's interests. And the British electorate, time and time again, has sort of confirmed that. You know, the British electorate has been supportive of the UK spending a lot of their money on overseas aid, for example. We've got to balance that against the, you know, the performance of the economy, and there have been some cuts recently. But, you know, there's always been political support for that. And when it comes to the specific point you mentioned, which is arms sales abroad, this is, you know, right at the heart of this sort of dilemma, as you point out. But we have a system in place that really scrutinizes this and ensures that these weapons are only sold conditional upon a number of factors. And it is also true that the security of our allies does contribute to British security and also contributes to wider security. And it is a, you know, it is a reality of the world that actually armed forces are part of maintaining security and also maintaining peace. It's one of the reasons why the UK maintains a nuclear deterrent, actually, because even though these are terrible weapons, we also believe they are part of maintaining a global peace that has, you know, in terms of global peace, has existed since the Second World War.
My third question is no less complicated, Julian. It's about climate change, which again I know takes up quite a bit of your business time. You've got this COP26, the climate change conference, taking place in Glasgow in November. Those with knowledge of the practicalities of CO2 reduction know that little of real effect can be done to meet the global emission targets unless the big players like China, like the United States, India, Russia, Japan, Germany, even Iran are all up there and do their fair share. There are some quite awkward countries on that list, and the UK, as you know, is way down that same list of emitters. What, in practical terms, Julian, have you been doing in Geneva on the UK's behalf in this area of climate change, and what more, in your opinion, needs to be done to achieve the agreed international climate change targets? By whom, and how on earth does the world get there?
So COP26, it's you know, the UK is doing leading two big international processes this year. We have the presidency of the G7, the group of seven largest industrialized economies, and we also are going to be co-chairing the Conference of the Parties, the 26th Conference of the Parties, this the big COP26 climate change summit in Glasgow in November. And you know, the objective of that summit is to really it's where the rubber meets the road. You know, 5 years ago in Paris, 6 years ago in Paris, we agreed that we should, you know, on these global targets about how you keep temperature increases below 2%. And everyone signed up to those. What we're going to do now is ask each country, what is your contribution to meeting that overall global target? Now, this is where it gets difficult, because this is where, you know, the Chinas and the United States and many, many other countries are going to be asked, so what's your contribution going to be? And you know, that goes from the abstract to the very, very concrete, and it's going to be very difficult, but it's hugely important, as you
say. And that'll happen in Glasgow, right?
And that happens in Glasgow. So what do we, can we do here? Well, Geneva is, I mean, one of the first things we can do here is actually show how it can be done. I mean, you point out rightly that the UK is way down the list of emitters, and that is not by accident. It's because the UK has been pursuing policies for decades now that have reduced our emissions. We are, you know, of the major industrial countries, we are in the forefront of actually having reduced our emissions. Now, some people would say, well, you've just offshored your emissions to other countries that produce, you know, the manufacture the goods that we import. And now that we've moved to a services economy, we import more manufactured goods than we export. We export services instead, which are much more carbon neutral or reduced. So there is an issue around that. And that's a hugely important issue of, is about how you look at carbon production right down the global supply chain. And that's something we're very much involved in. But there are lots of things that you can do and that the UK has done to shift away from, you know, the most carbon intensive forms of energy production, for example, you know, moving out of coal almost exclusively, moving first into gas, which is 50% less carbon emitting than coal, and then moving into renewables, which people 20 years ago said would never be viable, never economically viable. Today, very much are so, because of leading investments and stimulus by European governments, led actually by the UK. The UK, we shouldn't forget, was actually the leading member state in the European Union, driving these climate targets and these common climate policies in the EU, including carbon trading, which the UK pioneered. And here in Geneva, there are many institutions that can contribute to this. For example, the World Trade Organization, if we're ever to achieve a sustainable reduction in carbon emissions while also increasing our prosperity, we need to green trade. Trade needs to become greener. It needs to become less carbon emitting. And the World Trade Organization clearly has an important role to play in this. And the new and ambitious Director General of the World Trade Organization, Dr. Okonjo-Iweala, is very much focused on this. She's actually on one of the key working groups for COP26 on the financing panel. And we're wanting to involve all of the agencies that can play a role in this. And, you know, whether it's a humanitarian agency or whether it's the World Trade Organization, whether it's the World Economic Forum, or the International Telecoms Union with this digital agenda that it has. You know, there are things that these agencies can do that helps move our economy and our profitable trading into a greener, lower emitting mode.
These things are high on the agenda, Julian. It's not just lip service.
We know that this is what the UK is going to be judged by, and particularly in this year, this our first year out of all of the EU's systems. You know, the world is looking to the UK and thinking and asking the question: you know, can you lead? Can you lead? Can you deliver?
Yeah.
And can you deliver outside of the European Union? So we do understand. We do understand the pressure, and we understand the eyes of the world are on us.
Okay, thanks. My guest today is the UK's departing ambassador and permanent representative of the United Nations and other international organizations in Geneva, His Excellency Mr. Julian Braithwaite. And we're talking about multilateral issues and global Britain. That's what I want to turn to now, Julian. This recent policy, important policy document published by Her Majesty's government, introduced by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. It's wide-ranging, from national security to the international environment. It uses phrases like shaping the open international order of the future, being a force for good, tilting towards Indo-Pacific, building resilience at home, strengthening the nuclear deterrent. It's too serious a document to be just a wish list, Julian, but please explain how, especially at a time when the UK has taken on so much debt because of the pandemic, it will keep to such an ambitious plan.
Well, you're right. I mean, the UK has taken on a huge amount of debt in order to cushion the economy from the impacts of the pandemic, and for a period for almost shutting down the UK economy. And we haven't seen, the mass unemployment that would have happened if the Chancellor hadn't introduced the furlough schemes and the other measures. There hasn't been that mass suffering that, we've seen in previous economic downturns in our history. And that's because we have taken on a lot of debt at a time when, of course, interest rates are at historic lows. But it is true. We have, the debt will have to be repaid, and that's going to take many years, and it'll have an impact on our finances for many years. But within that, we are focusing on how we prioritize resources, and a considerable amount of new resources is going to be going into the armed forces, not just to sort of promote the status quo plus a bit, but actually to restructure. And, a lot of the investments have been going into, for example, the Navy. And people sort of ask why that is. Well, it is partly a reflection of this idea of global Britain, which is that, we're always going to be part of Europe, and the European Union is going to remain our largest trading partner for the foreseeable future. It doesn't mean that it's where most of our trade goes anymore. Most of our trade goes to other countries these days, and an increasingly large amount of it goes to the Asia Pacific, because that is the fastest growing part of the world. It's also the part of the world that does have the most, the fastest and perhaps most dangerous arms race in the world. And we do, perhaps more than most European countries, perhaps more than any other European country, we have friends, allies, history in Indo-Pacific. That means we also understand that this is about more than just, you know, the geopolitics of the United States and China. This is about what it means for countries like Singapore or Australia or New Zealand or Vietnam or Malaysia. And those are partners, allies, trading partners of the UK. We want to strengthen those links. There are great opportunities for British business, but there are also responsibilities for a country that wants, that has always seen itself as being part of and remains today part of maintaining international peace and security.
Puzzles me, Julian, and I wanted to come back to the military point you made about the Navy, but let's just cover another point very quickly. You talk of, or the policy document talks of Indo-Pacific, and yet I ask you the question, whither the Commonwealth and Africa? I haven't read the entire document, I just basically read the executive summary. I don't get the sense that Africa's even covered in that document. As you know, within the Commonwealth, you've got 54 countries, many of them with strong British connections, speaking English. 1/3 of the UK, of the world's population. What role the Commonwealth? Is Africa being left to one side in this global Britain that the policy document talks of?
So the Commonwealth, you know, I've seen the Commonwealth in action here in Geneva, and it's not the Commonwealth of sort of, of the Royal Tours and the Union Jack bunting. It's the Commonwealth of a network of countries, many of whom are very different and have very different, you know, day-to-day interests, but who do share a lot of history, and they share a lot of institutions.
That's why I made the point. Yeah.
They share, you know, the common law. They share often parliamentary traditions. They often share an approach to human rights. There's often big debates about what that should mean and the balance between economic and social rights and civil and political rights, and countries at different stages of development will argue that different rights matter more to their citizens than others. Yeah. And that's a lively debate we have in the Commonwealth. But it's not you won't get the sort of Commonwealth coming up with sort of big common positions on X or Y. It's a network, but it's a very powerful network. And I think one of the most tangible ways in which the Commonwealth manifests itself here in Geneva is, and it's very 21st century, is by providing the Commonwealth Small States Office, basically a common services, shared services platform for small Commonwealth members who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford to set up a mission in, you know, Geneva, one of the world's most expensive cities, but have a shared platform that allows them to come here and for their voice to be heard in the multilateral system. And, you know, that we support that. We put money into that, not because we expect them to support British positions. You know, that would, you know, quite, you know, that would be, you know, inappropriate, but because we do believe that, you know, because of their history, because of their values, because of their parliamentary traditions, because of their legal system, they're going to look at the world and engage in the world in a way that we can also understand, and that we can share an understanding of, and we can work together on many things. So, you know, what does that mean in Africa? Well, I mean, Africa is, you know, a continent that is, you know, actually developing very fast now. There are incredible, you know, opportunities for those countries. I mean, a lot of them do involve them being able to access global trading systems in a way that allows them to sell their goods without barriers. And, you know, the UK, you know, within the EU was a champion for agricultural trade liberalisation. And outside, you know, that's the question. Are we going to champion that? Because that's what developing countries, particularly African countries, want to see from us. And we have, you know, as a result of leaving the EU, we have also understood how much, you know, of these countries' European trade was actually British trade because of these, you know, historical
links
trading
and connections. Yeah.
I mean, Sri Lanka is a country that, you know, I'd never realized until they told me about it. You know, over 50% of their trade with the European Union actually came to the UK, and we didn't even know that. That's now amazing. We do know it, and we actually value those relationships. in a different way, because we understand actually how important that trading relationship is to our bilateral relationship. And that's true across Africa as well, whether it's the, you know, the big powerhouses of the African continent, like South Africa and Nigeria, or whether it's actually this development of a Pan-African trading single market. You know, these are developments that the UK is going to want to support. And Africa, in many ways, is the place where the sort of the, you know, the battle for the heart and soul of the multilateral system is taking place. You know, this is a system that, in many ways, you know, the West has taken for granted it played a disproportionate role in.
That in a way
our values has played a disproportionate role in, because it was built after the Second World War when, you know, countries like the United States and to a certain extent the United Kingdom were in a very preponderant position. Yeah. That's changed now. And, you know, we're going to have to engage with countries like China that have a very different view on many of these fundamental values. And occasionally we're going to have to stand up to that and say, actually, no, we don't agree with that. And we're going to say so. And, you know, but countries in Africa are looking at this and looking at China's economic development and thinking, well, maybe is that the country and is that the value system of the future? If we don't want that to be the case, if we do still believe in the values that underpin the multilateral system today, well, we're going to have to get better organized.
It's good you mentioned that, Julian, because before we draw to a close, we have to address the topical matter of the UK's relationship with China. Would it be an exaggeration for me to say that things do not seem to be going very well at present? It's an important relationship, but it also takes two to tango. So please explain the UK government's strategy and the efforts being made not to derail the relationship completely between the UK and China.
So, I mean, China is a hugely important country. And in the last two decades, it's gone from being a sort of marginal player in the multilateral system and in the global trading system to being one of the key players. You know, it's now gone from being a free rider in the global trading system, which is sort of what it was more or less when it joined the WTO 20 years ago, to being systemically essential to the global trading system. It's a very important trading partner for the United Kingdom, and we very much value that relationship. It's a major investor in the UK. We're a major investor in China. You know, those things are very important. But you also have to have, we don't agree with China on everything. We don't agree with their approach to civil and political rights. And the UK has international responsibilities. And one of those is to the people of Hong Kong. You know, we signed the joint declaration with China over the future of Hong Kong, which would guarantee the autonomy of Hong Kong for 50 years. And that autonomy is under assault. And it's been under sustained assault for the last, really over the last year. And the UK has stood up.
I think the Parliament closed the door yesterday.
There's a limit to what a country like any country can do in these circumstances. But one of the things we can do is uphold our responsibilities to the people of Hong Kong. And that's why we have introduced pathways for legal migration to the UK for Hong Kong citizens who are also holders of British nationality overseas passports. And that we see as part of our responsibility to the people of Hong Kong.
Last question, Julian, because again, time is the enemy. Are you at liberty to tell me, us, the listeners, where you're going next?
Well, I can tell you that very easily. I'm going to London. Now, what are we doing there?
That's a get-out clause.
There are some I's that need to be dotted and T's that need to be crossed. But if it all goes according to plan, it will be, satisfying job, which will also allow me to continue to deal with some of the issues I've dealt with here in Geneva. So this may not be the last you hear of me.
Okay, good. Well, I really sincerely hope that's the case. Julian, so many thanks for answering all my questions in your usual lucid and engaging way. We wish you and your wife and your children the very best along the way and hope that you'll keep in touch. My guest today has been the UK's ambassador and permanent representative of the United Nations and other international organizations here in Geneva, His Excellency Julian Braithwaite. Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
That was The McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.